Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Kennedy.
And for the next hour, we are going to be cutting through all the noise to deliver the comprehensive analysis you've been asking for.
And today's mission, it's a unique one. It's a truly monumental undertaking. We're going to do an exhaustive deep dive into every significant action, every activity across all three branches of the U.S. federal government.
We're talking executive, judicial, and legislative.
Exactly. And we're covering the period from the very beginning of Friday, December 5th, all the way through the end of Wednesday, December 10th, 2025.
The title of this deep dive is The Federal News Update for Wednesday, December 10th, 2025.
And we really mean it. We're talking granular detail, the profound impacts and, you know, the underlying strategic shifts that really define this period.
Mm-hmm.
You wanted the shortcut to being comprehensively informed about what might be the most volatile 6 days in recent federal history. And, well, this is it. This period was absolutely defined by volatility. I mean, rapid, aggressive restructuring. When you look at the week as a whole, three big strategic movements sort of coalesced to redefine governance itself.
Okay, what were they?
So first, we saw this massive judicial validation of unfettered presidential control over the administrative state.
Okay.
Second, you had the formal codification of a hostile, very transactional geopolitical strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And that was specifically targeting our traditional European allies.
Right.
And third, the domestic agenda became this internally conflicting mashup of rapid deregulation on one hand, paired with just enormous targeted fiscal support on the other.
That is the perfect summary. I mean, the ground literally shifted beneath the Constitution. The foreign policy doctrine was just thrown out.
Yeah.
And domestic policy became this paradox, you know, a cycle of rollbacks and bailouts.
That's it.
We absolutely have to start with that constitutional ground shift, because that legal transformation, it really explains the boldness of everything the executive branch did immediately after.
That's the key leverage point. The whole foundational shift came from the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. That was on December 5th, with the pivotal ruling in Wilcox v. Trump.
The docket number was 25-5057.
Right? That's the one. And this decision is, I'm not exaggerating here, it's one of the most critical legal developments of the year. It instantly reshaped the structure of key independent agencies.
Okay, so what exactly was the ruling scope? What part of the president's power was the court actually expanding, and which agencies were immediately affected?
So the court held that the statutory for-cause removal protections for members of two specific independent bodies were unconstitutional.
And those were?
The National Labor Relations Board, the NLRB, and the Merit Systems Protection Board, the MSTB.
So for you listening, that for-cause protection, that was basically a guarantee from Congress that these officials could only be removed for proven wrongdoing, right?
Yeah.
Like gross inefficiency, neglect of duty.
Exactly. Not just because the president disagreed with their policy direction.
And now that protection is gone, the president can just fire them at will.
It's gone.
So if those agencies were explicitly designed to operate outside of direct political interference, what was the actual legal mechanism the D.C. Circuit used to tear down that protection? Was this a completely new argument, or was the groundwork already there?
Well, the court relied on a long-developing constitutional theory. It's known as the unitary executive theory.
Unitary executive theory.
The rationale is essentially that the entire executive power is vested in the president alone. And to support this, they relied on precedents like Myers v. United States from all the way back in 1926, and more recently and more critically, the Supreme Court's 2020 ruling in CELA law.
So they're using these precedents to sort of carve out which specific officials must serve at the president's pleasure.
Precisely. The court argued that NLRB members, even though they're part of an independent agency, they wield substantial executive power.
And that includes what exactly?
Things like rulemaking, adjudications of policy, significant remedial authority in labor disputes. So because of that, they can't fall under that extremely narrow Humphrey's executor exception.
That's the 1935 precedent, right?
That's the one. It only protected officers who perform quasi-legislative or quasi-judicial functions. Think certain commissioners.
Okay, let's slow down on that constitutional principle for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Why is this unitary executive theory so controversial? I mean, beyond just losing expertise, what's the historical context here?
It's controversial because it fundamentally challenges the idea of separated powers that the framers established. I mean, the administrative state was designed to use specialized expertise, insulated from the 2 or 4 year election cycle, to manage these really complex areas.
Like finance or environmental safety.
Exactly. The unitary executive view says that any officer exercising executive power, no matter how specialized, no matter how independent, must be directly accountable to the president.
And the critics would say that concentrates way too much power in the White House.
It does. It makes the administrative state susceptible to these extreme, volatile shifts in policy every single time a new administration takes power.
And the immediate, the operational impact of Wilcox was dramatic, wasn't it?
Oh, instantaneous. The NLRB required as a three-member quorum to issue decisions. With the removal protections gone, the administration could immediately remove commissioners who didn't align with its direction.
And that rendered the NLRB what?
Non-operational. All appeals and unfair labor practice cases, which, you know, we're already experiencing a period of high backlog, are now stalled indefinitely. A labor regulatory body functionally paused. Just like that.
The long-term implications, though, that's where this truly becomes a constitutional restructuring.
This decision provides a clear, successful roadmap. I mean, by establishing that statutory limitations on removal are vulnerable when principal officers wield executive power, it grants the administration immediate, instantaneous leverage to reshape the policy and leadership of other historically independent agencies.
You're talking about bodies that manage everything from consumer protection to market stability.
Exactly. The Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC. This precedent lets the administration effectively bypass the entire Senate confirmation cycle for a huge swath of agency leadership.
Which accelerates policy change from potentially years to, what, mere weeks.
That's it.
And this shift wasn't theoretical. It was happening at the same time. Just days later, on Monday, December 8th, the Supreme Court heard arguments in Trump v. Slaughter,
which challenges the firing of an FTC member.
So this gave us a clear high court signal. What did the conservative majority reveal during those arguments?
The signal was just unambiguous. They seemed poised to expand presidential control even further than the D.C. circuit did. The conservative rhetoric focused heavily on the sheer amount of power these agency officials wield.
I remember the quote, something like, "Massive power over individual liberty and billion-dollar industries."
Without sufficient accountability to the president. Yes. And Chief Justice Roberts in particular, he referred to the nearly 90-year-old Humphreys executor precedent as a dried husk.
A dried husk.
Yeah.
That is powerful language for a chief justice to use about a cornerstone of administrative law.
It suggests the existing constraints are viewed as antiquated and, frankly, ripe for total evisceration.
But the liberal justices, they sounded some genuine alarm bells, didn't they? They framed this as an issue of competence versus loyalty.
They did. The liberal side warned that overturning Humphreys' executor would lead to massive, unchecked, uncontrolled power. They focused on the danger of politicizing expertise.
I think it was Justice Jackson who had that very vivid warning.
It was. She specifically warned that a president could fire all the scientists and the doctors and the economists and replacing them with loyalists and people who don't know anything.
So the underlying fear is that if policy officials are subject to political firing, all that crucial expertise just walks out the door.
Or gets silenced. The expertise needed to manage complex systems like nuclear safety, financial markets, or a pandemic response.
And then there was that crucial secondary question about the limits of presidential power.
Yeah.
Even if a firing is illegal, what's the remedy for the official?
The reinstatement question.
Right.
If a court finds a president illegally fired someone, do they actually get their job back?
Justice Gorsuch suggested maybe not. That an illegally fired official might only be entitled to back pay.
Basically, financial compensation for their wrongful termination.
Which, if that's adopted, it effectively gives the president a massive loophole, doesn't it? Just fire the official, pay them off, and replace them immediately with a political ally.
It completely nullifies the protection. It turns it into a fine the administration pays, not a substantive constraint on their power.
But Justice Kavanaugh seemed to push back on that idea.
He did. He called it an end run, signaling he may be inclined to reject that view. And while the court often views the Federal Reserve uniquely, Governor Lisa Cook, for example, is still navigating this, the precedent set on removal and reinstatement here will be critical for the entire administrative state.
So, armed with this massive judicial reinforcement of the unitary executive theory, the executive branch wasted absolutely no time. Let's shift to the aggressive, state-directed policy deployment, focusing on industrial ambition and the transformation of federal technology.
Yeah, the administration is really setting the stage for a dramatic overhaul of how the government functions digitally. They're framing artificial intelligence agents as the next layer of federal digital infrastructure.
AI agents.
Right, and these are autonomous, adaptive systems capable of initiating action. This is fundamentally different from current tech deployments.
But we've had AI in government for years, right?
Yeah.
The VA uses it for electronic health records. The IRS uses machine learning. What makes an AI agent different from those more narrowly defined AI systems?
The distinction is autonomy and scope. Traditional AI systems are, you know, they're passive tools. They classify data. They predict outcomes. They recommend actions based on narrow input. They're stuck in a single database or task.
But AI agents are different?
AI agents are dynamic actors. They perceive their complex environment, they reason through ambiguous situations, create planning objectives, and critically, they can act on that plan across different systems. They become active mission teammates.
Okay, let's give our listener a clear, on-the-ground comparison. How would a citizen's experience differ between interacting with an old chatbot versus this new AI agent infrastructure?
So an old chatbot or a traditional AI system might tell you that your disaster aid application is incomplete because you haven't uploaded your new home address. And it stops there.
Right.
An AI agent, though, if it's integrated across government systems, it would be smart enough to proactively cross-reference your latest address change filed with the VA or the Social Security Administration, and then use that information to automatically update and complete your FEMA application without you needing to do anything.
It takes initiative.
It takes initiative, and it coordinates actions across those silos.
That sounds incredibly powerful, but you mentioned a critical immediate constraint: data fragmentation.
That is the Achilles heel. Federal data is notoriously fragmented. It's across legacy on-premises systems, various multi-cloud environments, disparate interagency ecosystems. It's a mess.
And AI agents can't operate in those silos.
They cannot thrive in silos. They require hybrid data architecture systems designed to unify structured data like databases and unstructured data like emails and reports and videos to ensure that seamless, secure interoperability at scale.
So if they achieve that total data connectivity, what's the ultimate, almost futuristic mission they're aiming for?
The ability to execute missions that are currently impossible because of coordination failure. The classic example is disaster response.
Right.
The ultimate goal is an AI agent that could simultaneously draw on real-time FEMA resource data, NOAA weather models, DOD logistics systems for transport, and HHS public health records for supply tracking.
All in the minutes immediately following a disaster.
Exactly. Without these unified hybrid data architectures, that level of integrated, coordinated action remains a very distant future.
So moving from digital infrastructure to physical industry, the week saw an intense acceleration of state-directed industrial policy, a rapid succession of executive orders focused on strategic dual-use technologies.
The volume and the focus of these EOs, it really signals a commitment to what you can only call state-directed capitalism.
Using federal authority to secure key industrial supply chains and technological advantages globally.
That's it.
Let's detail these. Starting with airspace and drones. What specific actions were mandated there?
Two EOs focused on drones. First, restoring American airspace sovereignty. That one mandates a federal task force dedicated to drone governance, ensuring counter-drone capabilities, especially near sensitive federal facilities.
Okay, and the second one?
Unleashing American drone dominance. It explicitly aims to promote the commercialization and rapid export of U.S.-made drone tech to counter foreign competitors. So it's about securing both domestic control and global market share.
And the administration hammered the nuclear sector with even more EOs. Four distinct orders were issued. What was the major objective there?
The overarching objective is clearly to treat nuclear power, both civilian and military, as an essential pillar of national security.
And the EOs themselves were specific.
Incredibly specific. You had reinvigorating the nuclear industrial base, which focuses on the domestic supply chain. You had reforming nuclear reactor testing, which streamlined the DOE's testing and permitting process. And then the fourth, deploying advanced nuclear reactor technologies for national security, directs the DOD to prepare military sites for microreactors to ensure energy resilience.
That is a focused, top-down strategy to rebuild a complex strategic industry. And it looks like they did the same thing for maritime security.
Exactly the same playbook. Restoring America's maritime dominance, it targets commercial shipbuilding capacity. It mandates new federal procurement strategies to favor U.S. yards for non-combat ships, like supply vessels, icebreakers. And it directs the Departments of Labor and Commerce to initiate aggressive workforce development programs for skilled maritime trades.
Now, here is where that internal contradiction we mentioned at the top comes into sharp relief. In stark contrast to this intense, expensive industrial intervention, the administration concurrently moved forward with broad regulatory rollbacks and deregulation.
That ideological push for production flexibility and reduced administrative costs ran completely parallel to the industrial buildup. The most famous example from the week is the executive order maintaining acceptable water pressure in showerheads.
The famous showerhead rule.
It officially rescinded prior energy conservation program mandates that were aimed at water conservation.
Why is that rule, which seems so small, why is it such a strong ideological marker for this administration?
It symbolizes the prioritization of immediate consumer visible output and, you know, perceived individual freedom over long-term environmental conservation goals.
Yeah.
It's a low-hanging fruit policy reversal.
Right. It aligns with the idea that federal regulation is inherently burdensome.
And stifles production. And we also saw EOs focused on streamlining processes in other sectors, like wildfire prevention and regulatory relief for things like American coke oven processing. The consistent thread is boosting output and reducing perceived regulatory friction wherever possible.
Even if it conflicts with other policy goals, like environmental protection.
Even then.
Okay, that completes our look at the executive's policy blitz in industry and infrastructure. Let's transition now to public health and the dramatic shifts in federal workforce management, starting with what many public health officials are calling a fundamental challenge to medical consensus, the vaccine PM.
On December 5th, the White House issued a presidential memorandum, or PM, aligning United States' core childhood vaccine recommendations with best practices from peer developed countries.
This is highly sensitive.
Very, because it subjects the CDC's established long-term immunization schedule to a politically framed comparative review.
What specifically did the PM mandate, and what was the political framing they used to justify it?
The mandate directed HHS and the CDC to conduct an expedited review of core childhood vaccination recommendations. But crucially, the memo introduced a comparison point.
Which was?
It highlighted that the U.S. currently recommends vaccinating kids for 18 diseases, classifying the U.S. as a high outlier compared to other developed nations. It cited Denmark with 10, Japan with 14, Germany with 50.
So the argument is that the U.S. mandate is unusually aggressive compared to its peers and therefore must be reviewed for a reduction.
Exactly. The directive explicitly mandates that if these best practices are determined to be superior based on scientific evidence, the U.S. schedule must be updated to align.
And the public health officials are worried this undermines the CDC.
Deeply concerned. They feel this action, regardless of the scientific outcome, just undermines trust in the CDC's authority and will inevitably lead to declining immunization coverage rates.
Shifting to the federal workforce, we saw immediate sharp changes in policy at the IRS regarding telework. What happened on December 9th?
The IRS issued an internal memo, and it closed out all pending hardship-based telework requests immediately.
Immediately.
Citing the administration's overall return-to-office mandate. It's a move that severely limits employee flexibility, and it's having a profound impact on morale and retention.
How constrained are IRS employees now regarding remote work? Yeah. And what are the specific rules on those hardship requests?
Well, most IRS employees are now generally limited to just 5 telework days a year. And while you can technically still submit a hardship request.
These were previously granted for pretty severe personal issues, right?
Yeah.
Domestic violence, immunocompromised status.
That's right. But the approval process has been moved. Approvals must now come from the agency's top leadership or the Human Capital Office.
That bottleneck must be crippling, especially given the IRS's current staffing situation.
It's a logistical nightmare. The Human Capital Office is already completely inundated with paperwork. And why? Because the IRS has lost over a quarter of its employees this year.
A quarter.
Voluntary separations, dissatisfaction with the RTO mandate. So you have a massive backlog of over 8,000 reasonable accommodation requests, a critically reduced staff, and now a centralized bottlenecked process for even the most severe hardship cases.
And the timing is critical. This policy change happens after collective bargaining rights were rolled back.
Which means the union grievance process, which was a crucial avenue for employees to appeal unfair denials, is largely ineffective now.
So this philosophy of restructuring and shrinking the workforce is also formalized in the release of the new Presidential Management Agenda, the PMA. This is the overarching framework, right?
It's the strategic blueprint. The new PMA institutionalizes the goals we saw in various EOs, and it clearly ties the strategy to specific presidential promises. It establishes the criteria by which all agency performance will be measured.
What are the three core priorities outlined in this new PMA?
First, shrink the government and eliminate waste. That includes specific mandates to eliminate what it calls woke government and DEIA programs.
Diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Right, which are defined as wasteful. Second, ensure accountability, which is achieved by fostering a merit-based workforce and ending censorship. And third, deliver results with a very strong emphasis on Buy American procurement.
That first priority, shrinking the government, that's already well in motion.
Oh, yeah. The PMA just formalizes a trend that has already seen the federal workforce reduced by more than 300,000 employees this year.
And the second priority, accountability, that reflects the judicial shift we talked about earlier.
Absolutely. It gives political leadership more leverage over personnel. The focus isn't just on streamlining processes, but on establishing performance standards that allow for easier removal of perceived underperformers or those deemed insufficiently loyal.
And just quickly, on IT and HR, there's ongoing activity at OPM to try and centralize the technical systems managing this workforce.
OPM is continuing its long-term plan to unify over 100 disparate, outdated federal HR systems. The focus remains on developing genuine interoperability and centralizing human capital tech.
Okay, let's shift gears entirely to economic policy, specifically the agricultural sector. Here, the administration deployed a textbook example of that internal contradiction we identified earlier. Intense market intervention, using both aggressive regulation and massive fiscal support.
This dual strategy is fascinating because it just demonstrates the political necessity of balancing ideological purity things like antitrust and trade protection with pragmatic damage control.
Let's start with the aggressive regulation. The executive order on targeted anti-competitive enforcement signed on December 6th.
That EO, addressing security risks from price fixing and anti-competitive behavior in the food supply chain, takes a very aggressive stance. It links the affordability and security of the food supply directly to national security, which provides a powerful justification for government intervention.
What are the task forces it establishes empowered to investigate?
They're tasked with investigating and remedying anti-competitive behavior, specifically price fixing and market manipulation, and also security risks, particularly concerning foreign control.
And it names specific sectors.
It does. Meat processing, seed, fertilizer, and equipment manufacturing. This signals very aggressive antitrust enforcement under a national security umbrella.
Now, contrast that move to control markets with the massive financial intervention announced just 2 days later. The government is essentially bailing out the same sector it's regulating.
That was the announcement of the colossal $12 billion Farmer Bridge payments. It's a substantial emergency aid package.
How is that allocation broken down? Who's the primary beneficiary?
Up to $11 billion is allocated for the Farmer Bridge Assistance Program. It's specifically targeting row crop farmers, corn, cotton, soybeans, wheat, barley.
The heart of the country's agricultural output.
The purpose is explicit. Address market disruptions, elevated input costs like fertilizer and diesel, and financial losses from foreign competitors. The last billion is for specialty crops and sugar.
And here is the unavoidable political context. This aid package is necessary precisely because the administration's own trade tariffs are punishing these same farmers.
That's the core contradiction laid bare. This $12 billion in aid is essentially a subsidy designed to mask the financial pain that the trade tariffs are inflicting on a key political base.
And those tariffs are driving up inflation for everyone.
Consistently. Economic analysis shows they contribute between 0.5 and 0.75 percentage points to annualized inflation. It acts as a hidden tax on the public.
So the government imposes a tax, the tariff, and then spends taxpayer money to subsidize the sector damaged by that initial tax.
That's the cycle. And compounding it all, the Department of Labor acted to suppress labor costs for these same businesses. They issued an H-2A rule that reduced farm labor wages for temporary foreign workers.
Which saves employers money.
At least $2 billion in savings, but it contributes to wage depression for farm workers overall. It's a clear prioritization of lowering input costs for business owners.
That covers the domestic policy split. Let's go global now, because the release of the U.S. National Security Strategy, the NSS, codified a radical and frankly shocking reorientation of America's global posture, specifically toward Europe.
This NSS represents what senior analysts across the Atlantic are uniformly calling a seismic shift. It is not just a policy document. It's a formal declaration of adversarial intent toward traditional European partners.
The criticism was extraordinary. What did the document say specifically about the EU?
The language was unprecedentedly harsh. It warned the continent faces the prospect of civilizational erasure due to migration. It scorned the EU for alleged censorship of free speech. I mean, this is rhetoric typically reserved for hostile geopolitical competitors, not allies.
And the document moves beyond mere criticism to formal antagonism. It declares the U.S. intent to interfere in the political makeup of the EU.
Yes. The NSS formally declared the U.S. intent to actively cultivate resistance within the EU bloc to correct its current trajectory. This is universally interpreted as explicit, open support for nationalist and far-right parties across Europe.
How did European leaders react?
European Council President Antonio Costa issued a sharp public warning to the U.S. against interference. The NSS confirms a strategic retrenchment. It explicitly states that U.S. policy should enable Europe to take primary responsibility for its own defense.
So it's abandoning the bedrock of Atlantic security.
And shifting focus to the Pacific. It's also noteworthy that the Kremlin welcomed the strategy, noting it corresponds in many ways to our vision.
Moving to the Western Hemisphere, the NSS also included an expansion of the Moreau Doctrine, now being called the Trump Corollary. What does this new doctrine assert?
It is a radical reassertion of U.S. preeminence in the Western Hemisphere, framed as a condition of our security and prosperity. And this is primarily a zero-sum security test focused intensely on countering and eliminating Chinese influence in Latin America.
How does it transform alliances and aid?
It introduces an explicit conditionality. The policy mandates that U.S. alliances and aid are now contingent on partners winding down adversarial outside influence.
So it specifically targets China's control of ports, military installations.
All of it. Economic engagement is now a coercive security tool. If you want U.S. aid, you must expel China.
In terms of active military engagement, tensions escalated sharply this week regarding Venezuela and the ongoing U.S. military strikes.
The operations continue. President Trump added fuel to the fire, saying dictator Nicolas Maduro's days are numbered, and crucially, he explicitly refused to rule out an American ground invasion.
And this ongoing operation, especially that controversial September 2nd double tap strike, has drawn intense congressional scrutiny.
The scrutiny is acute. Secretary of War Pete Hegseth and Secretary of State Marco Rubio were called in for a closed-door briefing with the Gang of Eight. But Congress is not satisfied, and they are using their greatest leverage point. The NDAA.
The National Defense Authorization Act. What ultimatum did the compromise bill place on the defense secretary?
It includes a powerful bipartisan ultimatum. It threatens to dock 25% of the Pentagon's entire travel budget until Secretary Hegseth releases the full, unedited video of that controversial September 2nd strike.
And Democrats are still calling for his resignation.
They are, calling the strikes seemingly extrajudicial killings. They argue they must see the full footage to judge the justification for that second strike on the survivors.
Before we transition to the legislative branch, we have to address two key trade and tech decisions this week. First, the ongoing tariff situation.
The executive order modifying reciprocal tariff rates was issued, continuing the administration's broad trade policy. And it's essential to reiterate the negative domestic impact. These tariffs are a tax on consumers, contributing 0.5 to 0.7 percentage points to annualized inflation. A persistent headwind.
And the decision regarding the export of high-end AI chips to China, that was a major national security debate.
On December 9th, the administration decided to allow sales of NVIDIA's more powerful H200 chips to China.
And this was despite explicit warnings from the House Select Committee on the CCP.
Yes, who warned it could help China catch up to the U.S. in critical AI computing power and potentially assist their military modernization.
That seems to contradict the strategy of technological superiority articulated in the NSS. So why allow the sale?
The decision was conditioned on a unique revenue sharing structure. 25% of the revenue generated from these specific sales must be paid back to the U.S. government.
So they're prioritizing a short-term revenue stream over a long-term technological denial.
That's how it appears, despite the acknowledged national security risks raised by Congress.
Okay, let's pivot now to the legislative and regulatory branches, starting with a rare moment of bipartisan progress that impacts rural America the Secure Rural Schools Reauthorization.
This was a crucial, long-overdue legislative victory. On December 10th, the House passed a bipartisan bill to reauthorize the Secure Rural Schools program through fiscal year 2026. It now moves to the president's desk.
Why is that SRS funding so vital, and why was its lapse such a major issue?
SRS funding provides absolutely essential support for roads, schools, and law enforcement in rural forested communities. And this was critical because the funding had lapsed back in September 2023. Counties hadn't received payments since early 2024.
Which caused school closures, teacher layoffs,
severe cuts to local police budgets. Its passage resolves a major lapse in federal fiscal responsibility.
Shifting back to the NDAA, besides the ultimatum on the Venezuela strike video, the compromise defense bill contains significant personnel reforms.
Yes, recognizing that traditional civil service rules hamstring their ability to compete for talent, the NDAA includes provisions that would let DOD promote civilians faster and significantly increase the maximum pay for cyber talent.
And it expands special hiring authorities.
The cyber accepted services hiring authorities would expand to combatant commands, defense agencies, and cover another 500 hard-to-fill cyber roles. It's a fundamental recognition that the military has to adapt its HR strategy.
But on the opposite end of the modernization spectrum, a key provision that had wide bipartisan support was quietly stripped from the NDAA, right to repair.
A major defeat for service members and for taxpayers. This was a massive lobbying win for defense contractors. Despite wide bipartisan support, the language was removed during the final conference process.
What argument did the contractors use to lobby against allowing the military to repair its own equipment?
Well, groups like the NDIA and the AIA argued that giving the military the ability to fix proprietary equipment would compromise innovation, damage intellectual property, or cripple their ability to integrate new tech.
Essentially, they argued that maintaining their monopoly over repairs and spare parts was necessary.
Despite the clear logistical and cost disadvantages this creates for the end user, yes.
And the military had clear, tangible examples to show the cost of these restrictions.
The most frequently cited example came from Army Secretary Dan Driscoll. He highlighted a Black Hawk helicopter part, a small control nub, that cost the Army $47,000 to replace through the manufacturer.
$47,000.
Meanwhile, the Army estimated if they had the right to repair, they could make that same control knob in their own facilities for just $15.
$15.
It illustrates the multi-million dollar waste generated by these contract restrictions every year.
Moving to domestic policy in the legislature, the week saw urgent high-stakes debate surrounding the expiring ACA healthcare tax credits. This is a massive issue. If Congress fails to act, premiums are set to skyrocket.
The political clock is ticking. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer stated Democrats are united behind a clean 3-year extension of the subsidies, arguing that Republicans have no plan.
What's the Republican position? They seem fractured, but united in their criticism of the existing subsidy structure.
They're very critical of the ACA's mechanisms. Senate Majority Leader John Thune, for example, cited a recent GAO audit that found 90% of a sample of fake accounts were granted subsidies without proper documentation. So their goal is to reform the structure, not just stop the cliff.
So what are the primary competing GOP alternatives that are emerging?
The most prominent is the Cassidy-Crapo plan. This proposal seeks to fundamentally shift the subsidy mechanism by moving federal funds into health savings accounts, or HSAs, instead of directly subsidizing premiums.
Consumer-directed care.
That's the philosophy. Then you have the Moreno-Collins plan, a 2-year extension with a high income cutoff and a minimum payment. And finally, the Husted plan, also a 2-year extension, but with a lower minimum payment.
And it's important to note the White House position here. President Trump has weighed in.
He has. He stated he supports the concept of putting money directly to the people, not to the insurance companies. That general sentiment aligns most closely with the HSA approach.
Okay, finally, before we hit the judicial docket again, let's briefly touch on other regulatory activities confirmed during this period.
Sure. Despite the high-level policy chaos, the regulatory apparatus keeps working. The EPA acknowledged a final action-changing policy on regional haze plans. And the Spring 2025 Unified Agenda confirmed extensive planning activity on everything from pesticide tolerances at the FDA to chemical substance licensing under TSCA.
Let's pivot back to the judicial branch and the Supreme Court's current docket, which is wrestling with massive questions of political spending and the limits of private enforcement.
On December 9th, the court heard arguments in National Republican Senatorial Committee v. Federal Election Commission. This case concerns whether to further reduce existing campaign finance limitations.
And if the court rules in favor of the NRSC, what's the major implication for elections?
It would significantly increase the influence of independent expenditures and large contributions. It would let political parties and candidates work far more closely on messaging and funding, effectively reducing the functional limits on total spending in a campaign.
There was also that unique, high-profile question of mootness involving the vice president.
Right. The justices wrestled with whether Vice President Vance is a moot litigant if he hasn't formally announced a 2028 presidential run. It was a fascinating argument, testing whether courts should accept legal fictions or acknowledge obvious political reality.
And the next day, December 10th, the court took up a major case defining who gets to enforce federal law. FS Credit Opportunities, Court v. Saiba Capital Master Fund, LTD.
This case addresses the legal doctrine of the private right of action, that crucial ability for private parties to sue, to enforce a statute, even when the statute doesn't explicitly grant them that power.
So if the court restricts this implied private right of action, what's the long-term impact on regulatory enforcement?
A restrictive ruling would fundamentally alter the landscape. It would shift the massive burden of enforcing complex statutes away from private litigation and solely toward federal agencies.
And as we just discussed, those federal agencies may or may not have the resources or the political will to pick up that slack,
potentially leading to vast areas of federal law going unenforced.
And finally, the Supreme Court is currently holding an interim docket case concerning the ultimate limits of executive power domestically related to the use of military assets.
That's the crucial case regarding President Trump's effort to deploy the National Guard to Illinois, potentially against the wishes of the state's governor. The eventual decision will set a critical precedent on the limits of executive power for deploying federal military assets within U.S. borders.
This has been an incredibly complex and volatile 6 days. Let's synthesize the key takeaways for you, our listener. What were the strategic forces that defined this period of rapid restructuring?
The core strategic focus was the executive branch, newly empowered by the judiciary. That D.C. Circuit ruling in Wilcox v. Trump is the legal bedrock for everything else. It granted the president instant, massive control over historically independent agencies.
And that judicial green light allowed the administration to move aggressively on policy. Domestically, that aggression took the form of rapid deregulation in labor, environment, public health, while simultaneously deploying massive targeted fiscal support, like the $12 billion for farmers.
Which confirms that core internal tension. They're using huge subsidies to manage the economic damage caused by their own trade tariffs, which continue to drive inflation. It's a cycle of state intervention designed to mask the costs of other state interventions.
And globally, the national security strategy was not just a policy document.
Yeah.
It was a formal declaration of adversarial intent toward our traditional allies, the EU, coupled with the assertion of the coercive Trump corollary in the Western Hemisphere.
The theme of the week is volatility, a radical restructuring of governance and the consolidation of political control over expertise. The tension is just palpable.
And that tension brings us back to the core challenge, the compatibility of a fully unified executive branch where every officer is immediately accountable to the president, with the long-term specialized expertise required to manage complex modern issues.
What stands out to me is the potential long-term price of this swift constitutional shift. The D.C. Circuit's ruling crippled the NLRB. The Supreme Court is signaling a radical shift in removal power.
Mm-hmm.
This raises the critical question for you, the learner. Is a government where political accountability can instantly override specialized competence necessarily a more effective or better government for managing something as complex as nuclear safety, the next global supply chain crisis, or ensuring the long-term integrity of financial markets?
The push for quick political responsiveness versus the essential need for slow, steady specialized competence. That is the fundamental question left hanging over the administrative state this week. Thank you for guiding us through this exhaustive deep dive.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.